Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Friendly skies, my eye. United Airlines announced more cuts today. People, of course, airplanes too, which makes it kind of ironic that the price of oil is actually falling. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 4th of June. Great to have you with us, as always. I do hope, though, that for your sake you're not flying anywhere anytime soon, because today United became the second big carrier to decide it makes more economic sense to keep planes on the ground than up in the air. The company's been trying to merge with competition to keep its fuel costs under control, but that hasn't really worked out. So United is doing what American did just a couple of weeks ago, cutting people and grounding planes for United 1,500 jobs and 100 planes. Our New York Bureau Chief Joe Barshay has the story.
United Airlines is grounding all of its kerosene-guzzling 737s and a few older 747s, too. Richard Gritta is a professor of economics and transportation at the University of Portland. He says airlines can't cover their costs now that jet fuel is more than $3.70 a gallon.
The only thing they can do is get rid of the inefficient routes, which means a lot of small communities are going to lose service. Get rid of the older jets, which are not as fuel efficient.
Wave goodbye to United's low-fare airline, TED. It's coming off the beach and casino routes and joining the rest of the airline. Its coach-only planes will now fly to business destinations, and United's going to fit them out with new, pricey first-class cabins. Gritta says passengers can expect more extra charges, like United's new $25 fee for a second bag.
So now they've discovered, you know, just fragmenting all the costs, and I was joking the other day about what's next. You want to use the lavatory? Well, yes, that's $10, please. You want toilet paper? Well, that's an extra $5.
Hopefully not. But airline consultant Daryl Jenkins says we can certainly kiss low fares goodbye.
And you'll see the bottom 20% of the fares eliminated. So if you were a traveler who always went to someplace like Priceline or Travelocity or Orbitz to buy your tickets, you're going to be very disappointed this year.
There is one silver lining. Fewer flights could mean shorter delays at big urban airports. Good news for those of us based in New York. I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
So, the proximate cause, that oil thing I mentioned. Crude prices have been slip-sliding away since Memorial Day. As of today, it's down almost 10% from its high of $135 a barrel. The close in New York today was $122.30, thanks to new signs that demand, both here and abroad, is slowing. From Washington Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
The Energy Department says Americans bought less gasoline last week, and inventories jumped much more than analysts expected. Also, some rapidly developing countries like Malaysia and Indonesia announced they can no longer afford to subsidize the price of gasoline their citizens buy. James Cordier, the president of OptionSellers.com, says that's beginning to convince traders that global demand for oil will slack off.
The psychology is not nearly as bullish just in the last several days as it was 2 weeks ago. That should make prices plateau. And as we get into July and then August, we should see a substantial decline in gasoline prices. We could see gas prices back down to $3.50 to $3.60 in the third quarter of this year.
Cordier says traders are also beginning to think the Federal Reserve is serious about supporting a stronger dollar. That makes oil priced in dollars more expensive around the world. But Tom Wallen at the Energy Intelligence Group says there's still heavy demand for oil, so don't get too used to falling prices.
People need to be aware that this remains a fairly tight market that's vulnerable to the next hurricane disruption of production and refining, or a revolution in an oil-producing country, or war, or what have you.
And most retail forecasters are predicting average gasoline prices nationwide will easily top $4 a gallon for most of the summer vacation season. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Today's economic indicator comes to you courtesy of you. You're working harder. The Labor Department said this morning worker productivity rose last month. That means companies are getting more out of your working week without having to pay you for it. William Sonoma jumped out of the frying pan and into the fire today. The high-end gourmet cooking and housewares chain reported a 42% drop in first-quarter profits. It also said the rest of the year is not looking so hot. Given the problems with real estate, it kind of makes sense that fewer people are buying things for homes they're not buying. But check the calendar for me for a second. It's June, right? Smack in the sweet spot for weddings and for wedding gifts. Stacey Vanek-Smith reports now on why the season isn't registering.
That stainless steel paella pan and porcelain souffle dish were must-haves in 2007 when Williams-Sonoma profits were in the double digits. But that was before the gravy train stopped running. Williams-Sonoma expects sales to drop about 10% in the next few months.
This is the first time the high end's being hit in 75 years.
Retail consultant Bert Flickinger says normally economic downturns don't affect luxury retailers as much as lower-end stores. But he says this time things are different.
Right now, U.S. consumers are looking for the biggest bargains. There's a record amount of consumer coupon usage. Luxury retail is really starting to struggle, and the retail recession is just starting to hit.
Not to mention the wedding recession. The $69 billion nuptial industry is a huge chunk of Williams-Sonoma's business. And Flickinger says retailers are seeing fewer wedding guests on registries and cheaper gifts, or different gifts. 30-year-old Erin Larson is getting married this summer. She and her fiancé have a honeymoon registry. Larson says with the dollar sliding, it will help them live it up in Europe.
And it means so much more to us to get the present of sunset cocktails on Santorini rather than a blender.
A lot of couples feel that way, says Anya Winnicka, editor of TheKnot.com. She says department stores, cookware outlets, and other traditional wedding gift retailers are having to fight everyone from charities to spas for the bridal buck.
They're registering for their lifestyles. So if they're really outdoorsy people, they may look to an outdoorsy sort of REI. They can register at Home Depot.
Winnicka says the top dream destination for brides is Italy. And with the down economy, more brides may opt for a cappuccino in the Piazza San Marco over the cappuccino maker back home. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Sign me up, right? If you don't care for your cell phone service, your options may be thinning. There are reports this afternoon Verizon's talking to Alltel about a $27 billion buyout. It would create by far the largest wireless carrier in the country. On Wall Street today, it wasn't for lack of trying that things didn't turn out better. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Biofuels were the main agenda item today at the United Nations Food Summit in Rome. The U.S. and Brazil are facing heavy criticism for taking corn and sugarcane out of the food chain and using them instead for energy. Monsanto, the world's number one maker of genetically modified seeds, says it sees opportunity in the global food crisis. The agribusiness giant announced today it's working on a way to double crop yields while using less energy and water at the same time. And, oh yeah, spreading the word about genetically modified crops. Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Monsanto says it will try to create seeds that will double yields of cotton, corn, and soybeans and require 30% less land, water, and energy. CEO Hugh Grant says his company can do it in two ways.
One is through improving traditional breeding technologies, and the other is through biotechnology that protects the yield from hungry bugs and aggressive weeds.
Biotechnology means growing genetically modified crops, a widespread practice here, but suspect in Europe and Africa. Whether Monsanto can pull off these commitments is uncertain. Biotech critics say GM seeds haven't significantly increased crop yields so far. Farmers typically use Monsanto's herbicides and pesticides with the company's GM seeds. Ronnie Cummins is with the Organic Consumers Association.
What it's done is led to an increase in pesticide use and an increase in chemical fertilizer and, more profits for these companies.
But Cummins does believe there's promise in what he calls the souped-up traditional breeding techniques Monsanto says it will push. Carolyn Raffensperger at the Science and Environmental Health Network says Monsanto's commitments aside, a single technology can't solve the global food crisis.
It is not seeds alone. It is weather, it is soil, it is food distribution.
Monsanto CEO Hugh Grant says he expects skepticism about today's announcement, but given predictions of future food shortages, he says, quote, skepticism is a commodity the world can't afford right now. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Barack Obama rode last night's big news back into Washington today. The presumptive Democratic presidential nominee swung by his place of employment to vote for a draft federal budget, $3 trillion worth of spending recommendations that he is really hoping he'll have to deal with come next January. Elsewhere on the legislative calendar, the Senate's debating climate change this week, the Lieberman-Warner Climate Security Act, it's called. It's a bill that would drastically reduce the nation's carbon footprint by putting a cap on greenhouse gas emissions and then letting big polluters buy and sell the rights to pollute more if they need to. Cap and trade's a market-based approach, but the U.S. market would stop right at the border thanks to a provision buried deep in that bill's fine print. Sam Eaton's covering the story for us. Hey, Sam.
Hi, Kai.
Now, it's your job to read these things at the sustainability desk for us. So what is this provision all about?
Kai, it's essentially a carbon tariff.
All right, wait, a carbon, huh?
A carbon tariff, Kai. It's a less complicated way of saying international reserve allowances. But simply put, we're talking about a border tax on goods from countries that don't have a cap on CO2 emissions.
All right, so put this into context for me. What does it mean?
Well, the idea here, Kai, is that business is global. A cap on greenhouse gas emissions here at the U.S. adds costs to things like U.S. manufacturing. So how do you keep those manufacturers from basically picking up their roots and going to places like China, which don't have a cap on CO2 emissions?
So in practice, how would this apply?
Well, the aim here is to level the playing field so that these countries like China, say India, Brazil, don't have what's called an unfair advantage. An example would be, say, a TV set made in China, Kai. Say a ton of CO2 emissions were created during the manufacturing process for that. If you sell that TV in the U.S., Kai, and carbon is trading at, $35 a ton, you'd basically impose a $35 fee on every TV set sold from China in the U.S.
I'm imagining that since it's buried so deep in this 1,000 or 2,000-page climate change bill, that's a fairly controversial provision.
It's very controversial, Kai. First of all, it's not even clear whether it's legal. World Trade Organization rules typically frown on any trade barriers of any kind. Free trade advocates call it protectionism masquerading as environmentalism. The U.S. Trade Representative Susan Schwab went so far as to call it a blunt and imprecise instrument of fear. Now, the worry here, Kai, is that politics will trump commerce, and these rules will be used to protect inefficient U.S. manufacturers, not solve the climate crisis.
What we have then, just to make sure I understand this, is the Senate of the United States turning this bipartisan climate change bill into a piece of trade legislation.
Exactly. And if that happens, the argument goes, less trade with these developing countries could lead to less money that would go to things like cleaner technologies, which could then clean up their emissions and, you know, resolve what is essentially an international problem, not just a domestic one.
All right, Sam, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
If you really want to know what's going on with the economy, you're going to have to wait till Friday. That's when we're going to get the May unemployment report. It should give us some sense of what we're in for. But slowdown or not, at least one part of the economy is snapping up new employees. The government says seven out of the 10 fastest growing jobs are in healthcare. The need for registered nurses is expected to grow 23% over the next 8 years, which is nothing but good news for Youth Radio's Alyssa Wagner.
I tell anyone who will listen that I want to be a nurse. When people find out that I've been majoring in Chicano Latino studies, I get some pretty funny looks. But cultural competency is one of the new buzzwords in medicine. Take the University of California at Davis, where I go to school.
Good afternoon, Chicano and Chicano Studies. This is Leti.
This is the Chicano Studies Department. It's on the other side of campus from the medical school. But Professor Adela de la Torre is bridging the gap by planning a new school of public health that incorporates cultural competency.
It means recognizing that when you enter into a patient encounter, that you are not the expert in every domain, that there is an opportunity to learn if you understand the cultural background, the living experience, the lifestyle of your patient, you can better treat your patient.
Dorcas Walton is a chief nurse executive at Kaiser Permanente Hospital in Oakland, California.
We can have as many as 40-some languages spoken on one of our floors. It brings an international house here to me all the time.
Whether it's Greek, Arabic, or Cantonese, her staff has to be adept at things as complex as medical translation and as simple as knowing when to use eye contact.
One culture, you're allowed to look the person in the eye, and another culture says, no, that's disrespectful. We have to teach our staff how to demonstrate caring for the variety of patients that they're taking care of.
The latest census data shows 39% of Californians speak another language besides English at home. It's part of a larger trend nationwide. Professor Yvette Flores, who introduced cultural competency to me in her psychology class, describes her aha moment. It came when she was an undergrad doing mental health work with migrant Mexican families.
And it seemed ludicrous to me that I was hired as a Mexican family expert. When I was 18 years old, I was not Mexican, and I had had one course in psychology. That definitely shaped not only the kind of psychologist I became, but also the courses that I teach. Courses on mental health, psychological perspectives on the family, and a course on Chicano psychology. I also teach humanities and medicine.
Humanities and medicine? Sounds strange, but Flores argues that's where it's all headed. And I hope she's right as I get ready to graduate and use my BA in Chicano Studies to transition into a nursing career. In Davis, California, I'm Alyssa Wagner for Marketplace.
Alyssa's story was produced for us by Youth Radio. Coming up, air travel for the not-so-timid.
We've had a few people that have walked out, and they look at their spouse, and they say, no, I'm not getting on that plane.
But first, let's do the numbers. More worries about the financial sector offset news of falling oil prices, and markets ended mixed today. The Dow Industrials dropped a tenth of 1%, 12 points, to close at 12,390. The NASDAQ nudged up 0.9%, 22 points, to close at 2503. The S&P 500 traded flat at 1378. There are rumors of possible ratings downgrades of the country's two biggest bond insurers. You can imagine what that did to stock prices today. MBIA dropped nearly 16% on the news. Ambac dove 17%. Lehman Brothers traded up 2.5% on news it's cut its debt load by 25% and, oh, by the way, raised $8 billion in new capital this year. Verizon slipped 1% after the reports it's going to buy Alltel for roughly $27 billion. Bonds fell. Yields on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.97%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, a House committee discusses Iran and the future of the Middle East. The Global Summit of Women gets underway in Hanoi. And it's World Environment Day. The UN slogan for 2008 is Kick the Habit, towards a low-carbon economy, promoting alternative energy and eco-friendly consumption. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Honk if you think the ride to work's getting a little bit easier. Record gas prices have pushed more commuters than ever onto buses and trains. Believe it or not, it's even happening here in car-crazed California. Transit officials in San Francisco have actually taken seats out of their light rail trains to make room for more passengers. And it's all good, right? Less demand for oil, fewer cars spewing out greenhouse gases, healthier overall for cities. Commentator Robert Rice says the answer should be a resounding, yeah, it's good, if only our transit systems were prepared for the crush.
For years, policymakers have wondered just how high gas prices would have to go before drivers switch to public transportation. Now we know it's around $4 a gallon, because millions of Americans are switching to buses, trains, and subways to go to work. Rather than bemoan the spike in gas prices, we should be celebrating. Public transit not only reduces congestion, but also reduces the nation's energy needs and cuts carbon emissions that bring on global warming. The problem is we don't have nearly enough public transportation. Even more absurdly, right now, when they're needed the most, public transportation systems across the land are cutting back on services. Why? Because their costs are rising. Their budgets are strained by the same sky-high fuel prices that are forcing people out of their cars. And because their revenues are dropping. Public transit systems are financed largely through sales tax revenues, which are declining as consumers spend less. This is crazy. If public transit officials need more money to cover extra fuel costs and declining revenues, they could raise ticket prices a bit, but they should do far more. Expand whole systems. More buses, more trains, more light rail. If they can't finance this by floating bonds, they should go to Congress and make public transit a key part of the next stimulus package. Look, fuel costs aren't going down. Global demand is increasing faster than supplies. This is the perfect time to expand and modernize public transit systems. America hasn't been really serious about public transit for almost a century. Most of New York City's subway system was built over 100 years ago. Los Angeles ripped out its trams long ago. Boston's Big Dig, the most costly infrastructure project in modern memory, is entirely for cars. In recent years, only a few far-sighted and ambitious cities, like Portland, Oregon, have invested in light rail. What better way to get the economy going and save energy and the environment in years to come than to create a modern, efficient system of public transportation in America?
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Drop us a line when you get a minute. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says Contact. Aviation's not a fun business to be in right now, not for companies that fly planes, witness the United News today, and not for the companies that make those planes. The big manufacturers, Airbus and Boeing, have both said they're keeping a nervous eye on things. But a Canadian train company is seeing some opportunities here. Yeah, a train company, Bombardier it's called. It also happens to be the world's number three producer of commercial aircraft. Today it announced quarterly profits more than tripled. The company said rising airplane orders helped those numbers. But many of the planes that are selling best today were much more common years ago than they are now, Ashley Miltite reports.
The morning rush hour is just dying down at Westchester County Airport, 20 miles north of New York City. There are still several small planes waiting to depart, listening for instructions from the control tower.
Left on Charlie and cross 1129 with you. Just panorama, let's go.
One of the planes, destined for Boston, is a turboprop with two propellers. The pilot climbs aboard, starts the engine, and sends a deafening noise through the air. Over the past 10 years, airlines have been replacing propeller planes with small regional jets. Jets offer a faster, quieter, and less bumpy ride. John Storace is Westchester County Airport's operations manager. He says most flyers prefer the sturdy look and feel of a small jet. Some quail when they spot propellers instead.
We've had a few people that have walked out, and they look at their spouse, and they say, no, I'm not getting on that plane. I mean, I'm going on that. And then they get a little peaked, they get a little pale, maybe they want to faint.
No one's likely to faint at the sight of the latest turboprops. They're bigger, for one thing. Most regional jets carry between 40 to 100 people. These new turboprops carry more than 70 passengers. Continental puts 74-seat turboprops on various short routes out of Newark this year. David Kinzelman heads corporate development for Continental. He says there was good reason to replace their regional jets.
I think per seat, we're probably saving 30%.
He says it's not just fuel savings that prompted the decision. The government caps flights in and out of the big New York area airports. Kinzelman says using the new, larger turboprops gives the airline an edge.
This allows us to actually add capacity because in many cases we're now flying the 74 seats in place of a 50-seat aircraft. So we're actually able to grow the market with no more additional operations.
Despite those advantages, other big carriers say they're not planning to switch to turboprops, although that could change. Micheline Maynard covers the airline industry for the New York Times.
Jet fuel prices now are just under $4 a gallon, and it's up almost double from what it was a year ago. And if these prices stay high, I think you'll see a lot more airlines gravitate to orders for these new turboprop planes.
Orders have shot up recently. Canadian firm Bombardier is one of two companies left in the world that still makes turboprops. It manufactures the Q400 model that Continental flies. In 2006, airlines around the world ordered 24 of the planes. Last year, they ordered nearly four times that number. Maynard says more Americans are likely to find themselves strapped into turboprops in the next few years.
With the airlines pulling down service to cities, eliminating cities altogether, if this is the only way they can get there, I think they'll be satisfied to fly them.
The new generation of turboprops certainly offers a more comfortable ride than the old ear-shattering bone shakers of the past, but safety concerns linger. Last year, Scandinavian Airlines had a string of accidents involving the landing gear on its Q400 fleet. After an investigation, the airline ditched those particular aircraft, but since then it has ordered more of the same planes. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note with a question about social graces. What kind of card do you buy somebody who's lost their job? I ask not of idle speculation. Hallmark announced today it's laying off 335 people and streamlining its greeting card operations. The company said it's going to send some of that work abroad, Asia and Mexico specifically. Hallmark's privately held, so all we know is what they feel like telling us. It sells more than $4 billion worth of greeting cards and school supplies every year. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow scooted down 12 points, a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq rose 22. That's 0.9%. The S&P 500 basically flat. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, the pros and cons of a locals-only currency.
It will limit you to buying a few things from a few shops in a few streets in a tiny part of England.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.